Hello, Matthew Lee.
All right, and we're off. How are you doing, Mark? What's going on?
Good, good. So this is Mark Goldberg. I write for UN Dispatch and the American Prospect magazine, coming to you live from the American Prospect offices.
Yep.
Hello, hello.
All right, and I'm Matthew Lee. I'm right, you know, almost constantly for innercitypress.com, sometimes now for Reuters AlertNet, and I'm coming to you from an office inside the UN. For
there
better
you
or
go.
Worse.
And, you know, pro forma disclaimer, the opinions I'm about to spew are mine and mine alone.
My opinions can be attributed to innercitypress.com, but probably to nothing else.
Well, you are innercitypress.com.
I have the liberty to attribute my opinions to them.
To yourself. So interesting things today. Across town on Massachusetts Avenue, I attended a lecture, the Margaret Thatcher Freedom Lecture, delivered this year by former Ambassador John R. Bolton. He spoke to actually not a crowded audience. I was a little surprised, frankly. This had been on my calendar for months. I was excited to go, but it was not a packed house.
Mm-hmm.
But his speech kind of made me glad that he's no longer in public service. Makes me glad that he's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and no longer what he'd term shaking things up on Turtle Bay.
Mm-hmm. My sense is you were not a fan even when he was in public service, but not to.
No, not so much. Okay. The newsiest thing I think that to come from the lecture today, which by Bolton terms is actually pretty tame, was his recommendation or suggestion that the U.S. government extend formal diplomatic ties to Taiwan. And in funny and sort of typical Bolton terms, he said that the State Department is more likely to forge normal diplomatic relations with North Korea than it is with Taiwan anytime soon. He's always good for the one-liners, I think.
But I wonder. I mean, on that, let's say I know we've talked about North Korea before. There have definitely been some developments on the Taiwan front, and I think there's. A reasonable person can say, sorry about this. This is the true UN.
Yeah. Something coming in over the PA.
Yeah, it's okay. On Taiwan, I think what some people have said is whether or not you believe that a democratic nation of 23 million people should be allowed into the UN, there were some issues around the way in which they wrote a letter to Ban Ki-moon saying, please present this to the Security Council to have our application considered. And he returned it immediately to them and said no. And then was asked about why, and he said, well, because of the one China policy adopted by the UN in the 70s. But there are a lot of, you've seen, it's not just Bolton. I think you've probably seen a number of papers editorializing that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny, to Bolton's credit, he made the point that, this one China policy is not a creation of the UN, it's as much a creation of the member states of the UN. Specifically, he pointed to the United States, then he sort of gave his little one-liner about Taiwanese diplomatic representation.
But I think there's a due process question, right? I mean, whether they have, like to focus on the, whether, I've many of the journalists here were invited to go and hear Taiwan's case, so we did go to their cultural palace and hear it. And it is—I actually have to say—I mean, it's a compelling case, but it's so defensive and kind of like it's not going to happen. China could veto it at any time, so it does make you wonder, sort of like it must be for internal consumption. This current push, but they do have a right.
Well, they're in the middle. They're in the middle of a very tight and close election now as well.
But stepping back for a moment, beyond the political realities of if a permanent five veto wielding member is against you, you have no chance. It does seem like at a minimum they should be able to have their case heard out and then voted on up or down.
Well, not only is a P5 member state against them, no P5 member state is necessarily for them
because
well.
Because the
I
P5
mean, the
member
states is not making
right.
this. you know, and you know, an issue.
But I guess
you know, they sort of seem to have, you know, no support from the relevant actors.
Right, right. But I mean, but that doesn't mean that they don't have a kind of a natural case. And I think, I guess.
No, I think you're right.
I think there's I mean, and I'm being kind of cautious. This is a very like hot button. It's incredible how the UN sort of tries to dodge this hot potato. But it does, it, you know, there's something to be said. You know, there are people that would just raise the issue of Taiwan to sort of say, look how, you know, hypocritical and corrupt the international system is, and et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, if you lived there, you might say, you know, why aren't we a member? You know?
Yeah. No, I agree. And you know, this might be only slightly off topic, but you know who is a vociferous proponent of Taiwanese membership to the UN is Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, really?
He's backing a Taiwanese, he's backing a Taiwanese metal band called Katonic, who is also, I think, has a sponsorship of the government of Taiwan to go around, you know, playing concerts promoting Taiwanese admission to the UN.
At this event they held at the, it's called like the Taiwanese Cultural Center, but they have a whole building. It's like on 42nd and 5th Avenue. They talk about Ozzy. But they also, this is the thing I wanted to say, because it's sort of, it's one of these issues where like, I think philosophically it's hard not to be on their side, but the vibe there was, I have to say, it felt sort of like a cult. It's like you go into this big building and they usher you upstairs and there's like more staffers than journalists, and they're making their case. Then it's almost sad. It's almost like they have a case, but their opponent is so big that they have to kind of like sneak around. And then you have China, for example, will say to journalists here, if you even raise an issue about Taiwan, which I have, just not out of any, literally based on, like, why can't Taiwanese journalists come into the UN? That's the question that I asked. And I was quickly approached by staff of the Chinese mission saying, who asked you to ask that, Taiwan? It's like, well, no, there was a letter by the Committee to Protect Journalists, and, you know, we're always looking for trouble, and this is trouble, you know, now we found it. But so that's why it's really an amazing, it's kind of like it's a third rail at the UN, and it's clear that Taiwan has no chance.
Well, I mean, it's a third rail in international politics in general. It's not, you know, it's not something you know, unique.
No,
about
you're
the
right.
UN.
You're right. You're
you
right.
Can't
you're
have,
right.
Actually, you know, and this is actually something Bolton said. You know, he said he hadn't been to Taiwan in 6 years. The reason was, you know, for the last 6 years, he was a high level member of the State Department, and, you know, high level State Department officials just don't visit Taiwan.
Right. But you know what's
you know, because it's seen as unnecessarily provocative to China.
Here's a, I mean, a weird sort of interesting U.S. State Department / UN footnote is that the current, the highest ranking U.S. Official at the UN right now is Lynn Pascoe. He's the head of the Department of Political Affairs. If you look at his CV, you'll find that he was not only the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, but he spent time in Taiwan at whatever the equivalent of the U.S. embassy is there. It's like the American Interest Section or something.
Yeah.
So it's but what's weird is that made it particularly strange that he, obviously it's a Ban Ki-moon decision to like return the letter unopened, essentially. But he was, you know, I think, and then you'll ask, this is just the kind of question that if you even ask it, people look at you like please, you know?
Yeah.
Like sort of what's the point? Yeah. And I think that I could, whether or not that's the spirit in which Bolton raised it, I can imagine, you know, somebody could just say, you know, you should at least be able to raise it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's even more, I guess I'd say you don't hear about Guantanamo Bay here much either. There's sort of, people are things done by the P5 are just not, people don't waste their breath, in a sense. At least the journalists.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't even, like, the question doesn't arise. But But go on. I'm actually very curious to hear what John R. Bolton had to say.
Well, you know, his I actually just got myself an advanced copy of his forthcoming book called Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. At least that's the working title. It should not I assume that's what it's going to be. And you know, the takeaway from Bolton's speech was, you know, he listed all these numerous problems that he faced at the UN, and he said, you know, the only way that we're going to really change the UN is by making contributions to the UN voluntary rather than assessed. And, you know, this is actually nothing new for Bolton. He was saying this as he was an ambassador to the United Nations as well. I remember he gave a briefing to Congress in which he sort of made that recommendation. I think that is have a deleterious effect on international relations. I mean, you just can't have a viable UN that people fund when they want to, not because they need to. Mm-hmm.
No,
I'm sure, you know, I think reasonable people, I'm sure you happen to agree with that.
No, I mean, I think he's probably saying that, you know, hyperbolically. I was trying to think what the analogy would be to, like, the United States, where it's like you only pay taxes if you want. I mean, I wonder what his view is on that. And I'm sure he has probably some rebuttal that, like, if you're born in the U.S., you have to, you know, you're legally required to obey the laws, mm-hmm. whereas you people choose to join the U.N. But I think it's simple, unless he's a tax protester.
I don't think he's a tax protester. His point was that, you know, we inject this idea into the debate, and the debate itself is healthy because it might move us away from thinking that the UN assessments are obligatory, mm-hmm. and, you know, must be paid.
Right.
To this I would counter that for what we pay into the UN, we get back in return many-fold, many times over, you know, in terms of, you know, peacekeeping, you know, they have peacekeeping operations all over the world, you know, Americans virtually don't participate in these missions, but we help fund them, you know, and they advance our interests in places like Haiti.
Sure.
Lebanon, Liberia. Yeah, I mean, it just seems like a sneaky way to do what he is, you know, what his ultimate goal is, which I think is to, you know, dismantle the UN as we know
right.
it.
I don't.
You know, yeah, because to him, the UN is ceding American sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think we're go on because I definitely have I don't.
No, your turn.
I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think I don't think that making all assessments to the UN, particularly for peacekeeping, voluntary and piecemeal, is a serious proposal. At the same time, I mean, I think overall what I've come to think of, when I started reporting from here, Bolton was still here. Now you have Ambassador Khalilzad, and I think, you know, the one thing that I would say is that I think that they're the U.S. attempting to kind of like bully the U.N. and make it do whatever it wants, I'm not in favor of that. Strangely, though, there are issues of sort of like U.N. reform and transparency of the U.N., where even mm-hmm. if you view America as sometimes as a bully, it's a shame that they were also the main country raising issues in which I do believe, people should report on how they spent money, decisions are made should be transparent.
Yeah. You know, I completely agree with you, and I think that this ultimately is the tragedy of John Bolton's service mm-hmm. at the United Nations. You know, he came into the United Nations in the summer of 2005, when there was this. It was kind of a moment of great hope that the Kofi Annan put out this report that listed a major fundamental reforms to the UN. Virtually all these countries were on board for the reforms. Then John Bolton came in, and he staked this kind of maximalist position, mm-hmm. and it was very sort of zero sum in his negotiating style. And, you know, and that sort of undermined the whole process of reform. And the reforms, you know, the reforms that the United States were pushing mm-hmm. were reforms that Kofi Annan wanted, mm-hmm. and there were reforms that, you know, I think would make the UN a more streamlined bureaucracy and would, you know, bring a lot of transparency to the organization. And however, I think the way in which he went about trying to achieve these reforms were ultimately undermining to the goal of UN reform.
Right.
You know, for example, he struck out in this reform document. You know, had all these mentions of the Millennium Development Goals. Mm-hmm. Now, famously, he struck out all mention mm-hmm. of the Millennium Development Goals because, you know, I guess officially in some reading of the law, the U.S. doesn't recognize them as being something. Mm-hmm. However, you know, the U.S. kind of always lived with it and always supported the idea of the Millennium Development Goals. But to him, just having those three words in the document was enough to scrap the whole document. And that document also, you know, contained, you know, excellent and progressive reform measures as well. And this ultimately was the tragedy, I think, of John Bolton. That's why I think his book perhaps should be called Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America from John Bolton at the United
Nations. Right, I got you. But I actually want to say, and again, I I'm always focused more on the nitty-gritty, but the current development, I can't, nobody can say that Bolton succeeded in bringing these reforms.
Yeah.
But I think there may be a perception of people like, now he's left, and so you have the nicer, you know, the kinder and gentler Khalilzad, and so mm-hmm. reforms will take place. And I think what I want to say is that, in a nutshell, I'm not really convinced. And again, you'd think like U.S. foreign policy would be what it was, whatever the personality of the ambassador. But let me just give you an example. This is currently quite hot topic here at the UN is whether the UN's ethics office, which is a reform that was enacted, it didn't need, it actually was brought, it was part of that whole 2005 GA thing. They created an ethics office, which, as the U.S. government has a law, promises protection against retaliation for whistleblowing employees. So the office exists. It's upstairs. The director is a guy called Robert Benson. And about, you know, earlier this year, a whistleblowing employee of the UN Development Program, that was fired for reporting, he says, misconduct. I believe all this, but I won't even go into the specifics. He filed a whistleblowing complaint. The ethics office spent 72 days looking into it and then issued a memo saying, we found that retaliation occurred. However, the UN Development Program is arguing that the UN Ethics Office doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
And so this jurisdictional thing came up. Most people went back to what the there's a legal, maybe there is even a legal argument, but the it seems like a no-brainer that if the UN actually enacts a reform, it should cover the whole UN. And if there was this defense, in a way, kind of defense argument that they're not covered by the law, they should have raised it before 72-day investigation. What it looks like to most people is that they hope to prevail and be a finding of no retaliation, and when it didn't happen, they then said, we're not covered. And the problem is, there's two problems. Number one, currently, Ban Ki-moon has accepted this argument and has said, well, there's nothing I can do, there's no jurisdiction, which his own ethics office has said to him, please, without prejudice to you raising that argument in some future case, in this case, allow the investigation to go forward. And number two, surprisingly, there's almost a split within the U.S. mission here, in which we've talked about him before, Ambassador Wallace, the real kind of red meat Bolton acolyte.
Bolton appointee.
He's also doesn't know how to play with people. But he and Ambassador Wolf, who's the number two here, have both said on camera the UN Ethics Office should apply to UNDP in this case. And then, out of the blue, Ambassador Khalilzad said, we understand there's a problem, and so we support this alternative that UNDP's come up with, which is essentially investigating itself. And so it's very counterintuitive, because you'd say, wait, it's still the same U.S. State Department. But what many people, to cut to the chase here, in part, number one, like it certainly is quite at odds with what Bolton would have done. And maybe Bolton would have said the ethics office should apply and it still wouldn't have happened. But it's not like Khalilzad, with all the friends that he's developed here, actually came to a result that was reform-based. In fact, some people say his whole focus here is to get the UN to back up the U.S. in Iraq. And as long as he gets that, which apparently is on the way to getting, reform shall form. That's an analysis.
Well, I mean, if in fact the UN mission itself is split, and if various agencies of the UN is split, I mean, that seems to suggest to me, at least, that there are legitimate questions about whether the jurisdiction applies in this case. I mean, the UNDP has its own executive board, correct?
They don't have number one, they don't have an ethics office. Number two, they don't have an anti-whistleblower protection that's been established by the UN. And you have a good point. They do have their own executive board, but the problem is this executive board, even legally, just on its face, has no power to protect whistleblowers. It's a board.
Okay.
It's like a corporate board, right?
It's not a body that could, I mean, they couldn't confer the power upon themselves to do that.
No, I mean, they have no rules to do that. And in fact, the executive board is made up of the ambassadors of 36 countries. Now, here's another thing that was going to look strange to you. Is the president of the executive board is the ambassador of Denmark, Kasper Stauer.
Okay.
In the midst of UNDP getting its executive board the head of UNDP, Kamal Dervis, will nominate three possible investigators to replace the ethics office. And the executive board president from Denmark will choose the one, and then this is going to be called an independent investigation, even though the party being investigated is choosing the investigator. In the midst of it, UNDP is by all accounts, seeking to transfer 61 of its jobs, one of its procurement offices, from New York to Copenhagen. Now, 61 jobs in the scope of the world economy is not a lot. But this is the problem with having waiving the ethics office. The ethics office can't be bought. It would be obviously kind of, if not criminal, it would look terrible to have UNDP giving gifts to the head of the ethics office in the midst of an investigation. But when you have all the power vested in the ambassador of a particular country, and UNDP, which has $5 billion a year to spend, is totally free to change its disbursement strategy. Now, I'm not even saying, can we prove that they're moving the jobs in order to buy the vote and friendship? No. Can it have that appearance? Absolutely. And that's why the ethics officer just applied. I mean, here I'm stepping out of a journalistic mode, but I think that that's just in terms of like good government, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So sort of Matthew Lee.
Yep.
What sort of, how would you resolve this seemingly jurisdiction?
I think it's a no-brainer. In the interim, in this case, there's nobody disputes that if Kamal Dervis of UNDP or at Ban Ki-moon's direction said, yes, we consent to the jurisdiction in this case because it makes no sense to have the UN creating a whole secondary investigation that doesn't even smell right. They could easily, the ethics office could continue with its investigation and its findings could be acted on by UNDP. So that's what I would do in this case. And then if there's some dispute that the 2005 language, which said the office should be system-wide, wasn't strong enough, then you go back to the GA and you get something else. But there's to say that there's nothing that can be done now is just not true. There's a whole, maybe in some other discussion we can say why Ban Ki-moon might have gone along with this. It seemed, many people were surprised because he ran on a platform of like he's all about reform and transparency. So it just, today, in fact, a letter came out in which a Republican, but a Congresswoman, Ross Lentinen of Florida, had met with Ban Ki-moon.
She's the minority leader of the House International Relations Committee, which is actually now called the House Committee on Foreign Affairs.
There we go. Absolutely. She had raised this issue of the whistleblower in the ethics office to Ban Ki-moon in July. There's a letter that went from Ban Ki-moon's chief of staff or chef de cabinet, Vijay Nambiar, saying to her, thank you for your concern about the whistleblower and retaliation, but the ethics office has to be allowed to do its job. It's doing its investigation, which makes it very ironic for a month later Ban Ki-moon to say, oh, no, the ethics office has no jurisdiction, because they already offered assurances. Again, I'm sure this sounds very, Boltonian to you.
But it almost sounds Talmudic in a way.
Say again? I think it's the kind of thing that if this were a U.S., if it were even Larry Craig, much less like the kind of things that happen in D.C., it's not that hard to understand. Like, people are trying to make it out to be like, oh, it's so complicated jurisdiction. It really isn't. It really has to do with, like, a public...
It must be complicated to a certain extent if you have divisions within the U.S. mission itself.
I think the only... I'll go out on a limb. I think the only division is Ambassador Khalilzad and is the other, quote, ambassadors that work there. I actually asked Wolf.
So
I said...
The guy in charge has one opinion on things
totally.
And two of his subordinates
saying that the alternative explanation of that is that it's not that each of them read the jurisdiction differently. And who knows what the terms of reference of Ambassador Khalilzad are. But the focus, and he goes out of his... It's quite interesting, actually, to see the way in which he'll say, like, you know, since I've been here, we've gotten along with other people. I mean, I think it's very... I don't want to say it's consistent with the way you presented Bolton, but many people, I think, most people that I know, you know, that live in the United States would probably prefer Khalilzad to Bolton. But it's clear it's not just getting along. It's sort of like he's here... it very much appears from being at the Security Council stakeout. If you ask him about issues that are not Iran or Afghanistan, there's not a whole lot of interest. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's true. Maybe U.S. foreign policy, as relates to the U.N. right now, all the eggs are in the basket of getting the U.N. to say, we'll send more people to Iraq, which took place.
Yeah.
And in exchange for that...
Those are two top priorities. Focused on them. What you said about contrast about Khalilzad wanting to get along as contrasted with Bolton. Mm-hmm. You know, the problem with Bolton was not that he didn't like to get along with people, that he didn't get along with people, is that he was not effective as an ambassador.
Right.
I mean, I guess Richard Holbrooke, for example, was not the warmest guy in the world, at least compared to his predecessor, Richard. Governor Richardson, who was kind of a backslapper, got along with everyone, except, you know, Holbrooke was a very effective ambassador.
Right.
He,
sure.
you know, advanced American interests and you know, got results. Bolton didn't.
Oh, totally. No,
that's,
and I'm not, and don't get me wrong. I think I always said Bolton would have probably approached this by thundering that the ethics office must. I guess what I'm saying is that he's more effective, but the reform agenda is out the window.
The real momentum, though, for the reform agenda was that September 2005 summit.
The follow-up to that?
In
2005, they created an ethics office. So now this is the first time where the question has come up. This is actually by far the highest profile ethics office case since it was created. and it's being it's being totally pissed away. The only thing is, you know, the question is, a lot of people will say, well, okay, it still hasn't, you know, it's not oil for food. If like that's the standard here, like anything less than that is like just let it go. But it doesn't. I think you're going to see that it's something that's starting to, like, if you just look at the noon briefings here, it's not just me. You have questions from a good, you know, half dozen journalists. They keep arising because there's not a clear answer. Like, why didn't the ethics office apply? It's a very, they haven't been clear on how to answer it. And then they try to be dismissive of it and say, oh, there was a meeting. Hopefully this will be a transition away from this one thing. Ban Ki-moon went and did a retreat with all of his senior staff in Turin last week on his way to Darfur, which is a more serious topic, which we can turn to in a second.
We should probably turn to that.
But coming back from this Turin meeting, this was a big thing. The idea is he's going to discuss reform. The spokeswoman here was asked, did this issue of the ethics office, was it discussed in Turin? And their response was, oh, no, we talked about, you know, much bigger picture issues. And it wasn't clear what those were, but I think when he ran, Ban Ki-moon, I was here at the stakeout when there were six candidates. His pitch was, he's a manager. He's going to run the place right. He's going to stop promising world peace and first run the place right. Then maybe some peace. And I have to say on this one, it's not, it doesn't look right when the UN Ethics Office is suddenly found to not be able to do work that it's already been doing, and then it's dismissed as like, oh, that's just to close this one out, the staff union of the whole of the UN Secretariat and of UNDP have both passed resolutions directed at Ban Ki-moon to have the Ethics Office apply. And when asked what his response was, it was like, well, he's in Darfur. I mean, how can he respond? Yeah. And it is. Darfur is very important.
Speaking,
but you can just, if we turn back the page to what he said when he ran, he said no more flowery words. It was just as close as that criticizes Bolton, Ban criticized Kofi Annan by saying no more flowery words. It's time to run the place right. And I'm still waiting, you know?
Well, listen, I'm personally, you know, pleased that he, in fact, you know, does issue flowery words, like you said, and does fashion himself as a man of peace, because I think that is entirely the appropriate role of the Secretary General. And speaking of which, you know, the Secretary General is in is he in Libya yet, or is he in Chad?
Yeah, he was in Darfur. He was in Sudan, including South Sudan, for like 4 days.
Yeah. So he went to Sudan, then Western Sudan, Darfur, then Chad, where a new UN peacekeeping it's a multidimensional force. The European Union, good on them, have decided to commit troops to protect refugee camps in eastern Chad and northern Central Africa Republic, where Darfur refugees have spilled over and also masses of internally displaced people in those countries as well. So the European Union, led by France, I believe,
that's correct,
has finally stepped up and is actually going to put boots on the ground in Chad to protect refugee camps there, which I think deserves certainly our praise.
Totally.
This is the first Western group that's willing to put their money where their mouth is.
What's very strange is that Chad didn't want the UN, by the way. I mean, not to, I'm sure.
That was, you know what?
Explain that to me.
I have, well, you know, so a year, so it was maybe almost 6-7 months ago when, you know, maybe this was even under Kofi Annan, when Kofi Annan put out a report suggesting that the Security Council consider a peacekeeping force to do precisely what this EU force is going to do, but they, but the government of Chad didn't give its consent to the UN to do this, and I was dumbfounded by why they wouldn't want this. I couldn't think of a good prudential reason why President Deby of Chad would not want to have peacekeepers, and I asked all these Chadian experts, and they gave me disparate answers, and no one really could come up with a straight answer. But now at least it's good that that France has stepped up, and France obviously has long, historical ties with Chad, so they're obviously able to pressure Deby into consenting to this multidimensional force.
Here's an alternative explanation. There was during that whole time period. Chad beyond Darfur has its own problems. It has its own rebels.
Yes.
It has its own chaos.
Yes.
Although some people say the rebels are, funded by Sudan, whatever. I'll stop where the speculation begins. The facts are there was a rebel group about slightly more than a year ago marching on the capital of Chad, and France flew over and dropped a bomb. And they didn't drop a bomb on the troops. They dropped a bomb next to the troops. And, in fact, they described this as a psychological bomb, which is very funny. But it did scare the rebels, and they did leave.
Le boom.
So this always gave rise to a lot of questions. Like, I'd ask the French ambassador, like, what about the psychological bomb? And he'd say, no, not now. But I think there's one possible explanation of the president of Chad, Mr. Deby, being more amenable, and this may be to the UN's credit, being more amenable to a France-led EU force than to a UN force, is that it's not just that France has a long historical ties with Chad, is that France has shown a total allegiance to keeping the Deby regime in power.
And so
if you're going to allow in these thousands of troops, is it better to accept them from a party that's already on record as saying, you're the only game in town? Or to the UN, which might have to listen to other voices, might say talk to your enemies, might say there should be a peace process.
I mean,
know what I mean?
That certainly seems like a plausible.
And that would be from my point of view, that would actually be to the UN's credit that it's viewed as somebody that wouldn't just go along to get along. You know?
Yeah.
But it's still
One interesting point about this EU-led force, protection force for the refugees in Eastern Chad is that. The Security Council gave it a mandate of a year, and I will sort of eat my shoelace if it doesn't turn into a regular peacekeeping force sometime in the after that original mandate expires, or maybe a little after that. And if that happens, if there's a regular UN peacekeeping force in Chad, you could very well have peacekeepers sort of from Chad all the way to the Indian Ocean. You go from Chad to Darfur to southern Sudan to Eritrea, Ethiopia to Somalia. The entire greater Horn of Western Africa is awash with blue helmets. And that is going to be a tremendous challenge, I think, to UN peacekeeping. And, just another reason why, member states ought to, put up and help fund and help support these missions.
Sure. They've done like a presidential statement sort of authorizing an exploratory force. They will do the resolution, but they've yet to actually do the resolution for the Chad CAR thing. Yeah. But they're definitely there. And then,
but it's in motion.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no question.
It's going to happen.
It's interestingly enough, somebody leaked to me a memo of this new Department of Field Support talking about concerns within the UN of whether they can keep pace with the EU deployment and funding disputes. I don't really think it's not so much a smoking gun, but it's interesting to see that's kind of like the internal literally even getting, they have something called the Tiger Team. This is, I think it's a kind of a US term. It's generically like kind of like almost like a SWAT team to try to deal with this, but they couldn't get the 12 posts funded internally.
Well, that's the big the big challenge. You have all these new responsibilities are being entrusted with UN peacekeeping, and all these new missions being created, and the organization isn't growing with the people back. The numbers of the people back in headquarters are not growing commensurate to the number of troops being deployed, and that sort of that speaks to a lack of funding and a lack of support.
But I mean,
of peacekeeping, and it's like a dangerous situation, and there could be a crunch coming in the future unless we really start to support.
But I mean, the other thing is that you may have seen this on the U.S. side that there is a. Following the passage very much with Ban Ki-moon's urging of this resolution to expand UN presence in Iraq, they've refused to confirm this number, but it's widely discussed in the building $130 million to build a new UN headquarters probably in the green zone, and that's something where I think the U.S. has said with a wink and a nod like they'll support that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So again, it's not just John Bolton that wants to take the a la carte approach, I guess I'll say. Is even the kindle and gentle guys, the idea is like that's something they'll support. Now whether they'll
it seems entirely
appropriate. Oh no, absolutely. I mean in a way maybe they should maybe they'll build it too, but
yeah.
But
so now you mentioned earlier in a sort of a parenthetical remark that Ambassador Khalilzad was really working this UN and Iraq angle.
Yes.
I was wondering if you can help us.
Oh, I'll describe.
I hope I, so what's news? What's the?
Did I say this? This is. I'm not sure in our last discussion when exactly it took place, because when they were passing that resolution, this was like literally surreal. There were final consultations on the resolution. So most reporters were. This is sort of nitty gritty. We're waiting outside the Security Council, see who will come out. Somebody says to me, "Go check out this delegates' lounge," which is like the bar, coffee shop. So I run down there. Yeah. There is Khalilzad surrounded by 6 bodyguards, yelling into a cell phone, saying, "Don't worry, I talked to Ryan," meaning Ryan Crocker, the ambassador. "We're going to change the language." And it struck me either this is like amateur hour, number one, or maybe this is being done on purpose. Not for my benefit, clearly, but to sort of show, you know what I mean? We really are consulting. Because the Iraqi ambassador to the UN was sitting at a table. It was his cell phone. He'd hand the cell phone over. And you have this and then it was done. And it was, and even some of the ambassadors who later came out were it was the Iraqi government agreed to it. But literally, this was done yelling into a cell phone. So I guess I just want to sort of, in support of the idea that he's hands-on. He was extremely hands-on on that one. But it's sort of, also, I will say for the last few weeks, I understand it's UN world. So there's a lot of vacating, but the U.S. doesn't follow up on things that it says it's going to do. This is you're going to think it's unrelated, but I see it as related. Last month, the U.S. made, U.S. and some others, but mostly the U.S., made a lot of noise about this missile that fell in Georgia, 65 kilometers from Tbilisi. Georgia claims that Russia dropped a missile on it. I don't know if you saw this story, but in the UN world,
I missed it.
It's also pretty, when a major power, is alleged to have dropped a missile on its neighbor, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
So at the UN, there were all these calls. Georgia held 2 press conferences. Russia held 1. The U.S., and this was Ambassador Jackie Sanders, who's not their main, they have a whole team, right? She said, "We are going to get this on the Security Council agenda. This is extremely troubling." Russia claims it didn't do it. So there's some factual disputes, but there's been 7 countries, Latvia, Lithuania, UK, they've gone and said it's a Russian missile. Whatever, no one can get into the motives, why they would drop it, But lo and behold, this month's Security Council agenda was just released, I guess it was yesterday. There was a press conference by the French ambassador, who's the president for the month. And nowhere on the schedule, even in the footnotes, is Georgia. So I asked, what's up with the missile? And he said, nobody asked to have it on. So I guess what I want to, it's obviously my goal to find out, maybe this is savvy play on the U.S.'s part. Maybe they, this is not true. This would be speculation. Maybe they said to Russia, "We won't bring it up if you allow Kosovo to be independent." But if it was just inattention and sloppiness, that's a new low. I mean, what's going, and not because the U.S. should be fighting with Russia, but because they said publicly they were going to pursue this to the end.
Yeah.
Where's the beef? Whatever.
I have absolutely. This was something that I must have.
Tell me about that missile.
I don't remember
that missile was hard
between. I don't remember a war between Georgia. And
no, it's no. There's Abkhazia. No, there's South Ossetia. They're always dicking around there.
I know.
No, but this is the kind of it is on this. I'm just saying to you.
Yeah.
I guess I'm saying. I don't. This is neither a left wing or a right wing issue.
No,
it's just
no.
Let's be serious.
Yeah. So I don't know if we'll get a chance to speak before the opening of the General Assembly in 2 weeks.
It's coming right up. Tuesday, September
25th. It's coming right up. Always an exciting moment at the UN. Last year we had Hugo Chavez sort of overly sensitive olfactory senses, Sulfuro. And you've always have the Ahmadinejad. I noticed that they released a schedule of the speakers, and the UN bureaucrats in their infinite wisdom put George Bush and Ahmadinejad on different days.
That was
or at least one's in the morning, one's in the afternoon, so they don't have to meet each other in the hallway. So is there sort of excitement and buzz?
No, there's a lot of buzz, and actually there are going to be some events before. There's a lot of, I'm just looking, in terms of the schedule, the most buzz that I've heard is around Pervez Musharraf, whether he actually will still be in power. He's the third speaker
That's
So that's the sort of, that's the betting line over here. And I won't say how the odds swing every day, but that one people are looking forward to. But there are also these, and this is another kind of UN/Ban Ki-moon issue. There are, first of all, in the days before, because all these heads of state and heads of government are coming, there's a meeting of the Middle East Quartet. There's various. There's a meeting on Iraq.
Well, there's also
there's the climate
change.
Full day on climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and you know, God bless them. Yep. I mean, this is great. You know, I think on climate change, you know, you obviously have your issues with Ban Ki-moon, sure. But I think that, you know, he is doing the Lord's work here with climate change. You know, to me at least, you know, people look back at Kofi Annan and call him the human rights, mm-hmm. The human rights Secretary General. You know, he, in his, you know, throughout his tenure, tried to inject human rights into every aspect of the UN's mm-hmm. work. And to me, you know, at least, you know, he's obviously only been on the job for, you know, less than a year, but already he seems to be sort of the climate change Secretary General. He's met with Arnold Schwarzenegger to look at, you know, innovative green technologies. He's overseeing the remodeling of the UN, the Capital Master Plan. The UN building is going to become a LEED certified green building. You know, he wrote that Washington Post op-ed about, you know, talking about climate change and conflict. You know, now he's convening this big, you know, heads of state meeting. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think, you know, you know, the more people that can get that onto the agenda of world leaders, the better.
No. Oh, I mean, I was going to say just sort of and sort of snarkily, but sort of the human rights drum beating has definitely fallen off in the last 8 months. But there's no question that the climate change is there's a lot more talk about it. And I think just to cover anything, you have to be you can't drink the Kool-Aid. But there are,
sure.
I mean, one question that I think is an ongoing one. He's overall. He's said, you know, he's not a person of talk. He's a person of results, tangible results. So I think on some of these, on the climate change thing, there was a pre-GA briefing here the other day. And I guess the question is, at some point, somebody's going to need to say, how are we going to measure the success of this? Of the UN is very much positioning itself as the central party to try to you know, come up with something to go beyond 2012 and the Kyoto Protocol, and at the same time, the UN has to do it. There was a meeting in Vienna at which most NGO environmental NGOs, Greenpeace and others, had said, you know, if they don't come out singing from the same choir book about reductions of 25 to 40% by 2020, it's a failure, and they didn't.
Yeah.
So I asked the UN's guy, the number two environmental guy. You know, was it a failure? And oh no, it was wonderful. So it's the truth is some. I understand you have to be positive.
Yeah, at the same time, this meeting in Vienna was really a precursor to the big meeting, which is taking place in Bali in December.
Totally.
And you know, this meeting in Vienna was to kind of test the waters and specifically to see how much the U.S. and other non-Kyoto signatories like China are willing to give on this issue, are willing to, you know, how if they're actually sort of willing to make a commitment and, you know, kind of feel what the situation is going to be like in mm-hmm. Bali. But that's really when
so you know, even since I asked the question, one of the other UN environmental staffers came over and said, you really shouldn't expect much out of Bali either. So I just want to, I mean,
we'll see.
I don't mean to say, I think he's very much chosen. I guess a skeptic, I would just, he's very much, that is like his signature issue. I believe that there are two issues that they've said are their issues. This is, would be the Bannon administration. Climate change and Darfur. These are the two.
Yeah.
And measure them by it. And all I guess all I'm saying is that it's somebody needs to say, let's say before Bali, not that it's Ban Ki-moon's fault if countries say screw you, but if you're about results and you have two main issues, then at a certain point you have to say this is what we're going for and measure us by whether we accomplish it or not.
I got to interrupt you for a second. I just noticed above my right shoulder is a big picture of Al Gore from the November 2006 issue of the American Prospect magazine.
Oh, there you go.
Staring down at me and pointing.
Oh, really? No. I'm sure you feel that burning.
It was an article written by Ezra Klein about sort of whether or not Gore is going to run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Al Gore's talking to me, and he wants me to tell
go
you.
Ahead.
That the success or failure of this Bali meeting is really going to be up to how much the Kyoto non-signatories, namely the U.S. and China, are willing to give.
Absolutely.
That was Al Gore talking.
I don't blame Ban Ki-moon for the climate, by the way. I really don't. I'm just saying there are times here where other things are going bad, and they're like, but the climate. And it's like, I don't blame him if it's getting hotter, but I don't necessarily exactly as you said it. It really comes down to larger players. Just as an aside on Al Gore, I don't even know why, but there was this New Yorker profile of him before his kind of comeback on the environment. I don't know if you remember. It was an incredible one where he was like, he was living in Nashville and like eating pork chops and just, they said he was very relaxed. And it was a beautiful piece. But when you think back to it, like, he's still eating pork chops, but he really, that really portrayed him as kind of like, you know, the lion just like chilling out, and he's back, you know? I don't know.
He's back. You know, God bless.
Pork chops and all. No, he's excellent. There's no question.
Pork chops and all.
But here's the thing. At least Al Gore, this is the kind of, you know, and maybe it's just, you know, low-level sniping.
Yeah.
But the most basic kind of climate change thing, it would seem to me, is like offsetting the carbon emissions of your travel. Right? Even the president of the GA. I mean, maybe it's hype. I don't know. You know, I'm not an environmental expert. But I know that... During the Gore concerts, musicians were subject to criticism for like flying halfway around the world to play on a private jet, right? Like it's a snarky criticism, but it's one that's so easy to take off the table. The General Assembly president did her climate change event in the middle of the summer, flew in 60 experts, they met for 2 days, and they made a big deal that they offset all the emissions. And so I asked, how much did it cost? And the answer was $2,500. They made an investment in something in Kenya. They claimed that this was all of the travel and the all of the emissions of the UN headquarters for 2 days. So then you turn to Ban Ki-moon's spokesperson and you say, okay, in the upcoming climate change day, are you going to offset? And they say, we don't know. Now they say they know, they're checking it out. But I guess that's more of, you could say, a matter of like optics.
Symbolic.
You know, that's pretty cheap. Just freaking write the check. But thing is that then you go down the road and you say, well, why aren't you offsetting it every day? You know, why just this day? Or, you know, I think...
There's, you know, in the Capital Master Plan, which I referred to before, which is this, like, big renovation of the dilapidated UN building.
Totally.
You probably have an air conditioner dripping on you right now.
Right, no, it is amazing over here. Speaking of which...
They're greening the building. You know, they're making it a LEED certified building.
And I'm not sure if that... But again, and not that this is a referendum on Ban Ki-moon, I'm just saying this Capital Master Plan idea has been around for many years. So it's sort of...
It has. It certainly has. And it has lots of ups and downs, but, you know, it sort of finally for once seems...
So just as Ban Ki-moon is not responsible for... some of the environmental aspects of the Capital Master Plan, nor can he be held responsible for the find last week, or the alleged find of the toxin phosgene from Iraq in the soon to be closed down office of UNMAVIC, the Monitoring Inspection and Verification Unit of Iraq.
Yes.
This came from 1996, so this is obviously well before his time. But they did find it, and the FBI did come, and it was quite a stir here, saying that they had nerve agent inside the UN.
And we learned today
that it was, in fact,
this
not.
Nerve agent was over-the-counter cleaning product.
Mislabeled. And then, but this is turning, I agree. I sort of just like, the whole thing was a cluster. The thing is that as one of the stories quoted law enforcement, this raises other issues. This wasn't like the UN's critics said, we accuse you of having nerve agent, and then they weren't validated. This was the UN itself saying, oh my God, we've had these files for 10 years, we don't know what they are, and we think it's a nerve agent. So even if it's not a nerve agent, maybe they were good to cry chicken, you know, or whatever, the sky is falling, Chicken Little. But people are saying, like, what's going on here? And in fact, here's the irony. That office has been eliminated by the Security Council, UNMAVIC. It's done.
Yeah.
They still have, like, a Scud missile motor. They have gyroscopes.
Yeah.
There's talk now of like anthrax. I don't know if that's true. I don't want to go down that road. But and this is not even Ban Ki-moon's fault in the least. It's actually the Security Council's fault. If you're going to close down a mandate like that, you have to deal with the archives, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, listen,
it's insane. It's very funny.
It makes sense. The one thing that this nerve agent in the UN building, you know, they're bringing, you know, this phosgene into the U.S.
Sure.
You know, I monitor a lot of the blogs and commentators on this. The right-wing blogs had a field day with this. Like, oh, look, the UN's out to get us. They're going to, kill us with nerve agent. And, they used that point to launch into their, you know, broader attacks on the UN. Claudia Rosette, for example, once again argued that we ought to suspend funding to the UN and use this as somehow her jumping off point. And, you know, I see no, updates or apologies for
Although, in Claudia's defense, and this one I'm willing, if you saw how it played out here, this was not the perception that might be now somehow that the UN is like vindicated from an attack by its critics. We were all here on Thursday working, and they said there's a press conference because we found phosgene. You know what I mean? It wasn't like Claudia Rosette found phosgene.
No, I know. But you know, they use this to launch.
But I think I think there is a wider point, or maybe I'm part of some right wing conspiracy. But I think the problem is. To me, the interesting question wasn't. I mean, we can't. I don't know if it's phosgene or not. I don't really. It's not. Yeah. And even if it, the question is what safeguards are in place? I.e., not could one an error take place? But I mean, even New York City, has started saying, are there fire people allowed in if there's a fire? Can they conduct an inspection of the UN building? The issue is also like, do UN employees have normal labor rights protections? I think there's a whole legal. Yeah. It's one thing to say, you know, for UN officials to do their work, they shouldn't be able to be arrested in countries, right? Like if you send a human rights rapporteur to Sudan,
or they shouldn't have to pay their parking tickets in New York City.
But see, parking tickets is one thing. But in New York, this may be a New York story rather than a nationwide. But two firemen died in this fire down by Ground Zero in the Deutsche Bank building. I guarantee you, it's not just the New York Post and the Daily News. The New York Times, everyone is freaking out on this story. How could the firemen have died? Why wasn't the building inspected? And then, and so now the elephant in the room is that the UN building is not inspected. Because it's international, it doesn't have a sprinkler.
Yes.
It's a 38-story building.
That's the whole impetus behind this big renovation, the Capitol Massive.
The city of New York has asked the UN to install sprinklers, and the UN has said no. It's too expensive.
Yeah, I mean it's been a long and arduous process to raise the funds for the renovation, to find the right contractors, and you know it's been a long process, but at least finally.
No, I agree. No,
it seems there's some progress. I have to take off.
Right.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sure there are problems in Myanmar, but sadly they probably will still be there next time we speak.
I think we'll be able to talk about Myanmar next time. Which I hope is really soon. I'm very sorry to have
Not at all. I'm the one, I'm the one that had other problems. So it's really, I hope it's kind of like reaction formation. Like I feel like I may veer to the right to sort of,
I think we have very good conversations. I enjoy chatting with you.
Okay, no.
Frankly, hopefully I think they're informative to the viewers more than anything else. Because, I feel like a lot of times, you and I, know these things. And hopefully it's informative to the viewers out there, and Al Gore looking down upon me.
No, definitely. Well, I think you did him proud. Yeah. That's all I can say. You did him proud.
All right. Well, thank you, Matthew. I hope to see you soon. I might be up in New
Excellent.
York for the World
Come
Summit.
On down. Musharraf. Catch him while you can,
I'll say Pervez and Munir Akhmed.
Right
by his side.
Okay.
Thanks so much,
Great.
Matthew. See you.
Bye-bye.